My name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church and where we can meet and hear from those that have made their faith count. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well by email, ogc@accessradio.biz. That's accessradio.biz, B-I-Z. So please enjoy today's guest, who loves arranging her life around coffee. She is known for being an author of Christian fantasy novels, which explore soulful stories. So for someone that loves coffee, playing netball, hanging out with her husband, why would she want to write dystopian novels? What exactly are dystopian novels? What is the connection between her dystopian themes and her own Christian faith? Why has she a passion for young people's lives, especially as they are entering the world of work and the life thereafter? Where does she get the names for her books such as Tulo City, AJ and Jenny? Without giving away the plots, what are Son of Endless Days and its recently released sequel, Storm at Dusk, all about? And who is it for? And why can I call her Lydia, yet the books say LG? Better meet our guest then and find out all the answers to these and much more. Gives me great pleasure to welcome LG Jenkins, or should I say Lydia for short. Lydia, thanks for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm all right, Martin. Thank you for having me today.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Well, before we start then, I always ask our guests, where are we speaking to you from? So where are you, please?
I am in York in the north of England, which is a lovely, beautiful medieval city. But today it's quite rainy, which makes you feel a bit cold, to be honest.
You see, you're understanding Northern Ireland weather straight away when it says rainy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But very green.
It is, 50 Shades of Green, which could be a title for a book series, and no doubt will go into your series very soon indeed. He says linking in very nicely. But before we do that, five important questions, or maybe not so important questions. Let's see how you get on with these, if that's all right, please, Lydia.
Yeah, sure.
Question one. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
So there's a person that jumps to mind straight away, mainly because of her recent just massive success, and that's Taylor Swift. Mainly because I really recognise her talent as a storyteller.
Yeah.
And so I would just want to quiz her on how she writes, and also seeing the level of her success and wanting to really unpick how she deals with that and who she actually is as a person, because you never know through the media.
Yes.
Yeah, I just find the whole narrative behind her recent boom, if you like, quite fascinating. So yeah, that's the first person that jumps to mind.
Well, that's a great answer. Obviously, over a meal, and you might be cooking her the meal as well. What would you cook her?
I have no idea. She might have some special diet. I don't know. I might have to talk to a team, I think.
Oh yeah. Get your team, obviously, to talk to her team to find out.
Yeah, my very big, large team.
Oh yeah. Well, that's a great answer. Thank you very much indeed. I can see this podcast is going to be great. Question two. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable, please, Lydia?
I actually think I have favourite ones at different times in my life because of where I feel I am. And the recent one that sort of has been a real revelation to me is the story of Cain and Abel.
Uh-huh.
And actually I've been sort of dwelling on when things in life don't go the way that you want them to go.
Yeah, yeah.
And when that happens, jealousy does become a real problem when you see other people having the things that you wanted. And a real revelation to me was that when Cain is jealous of Abel, he's first angry with God rather than direct. His jealousy was rooted in his anger to God because he'd not been given what he expected. And I was like, oh, that's a real revelation of actually, am I angry with God? And recognizing that and actually working through that with God and understanding, oh, okay, maybe I am angry with you here and I need to really process that. And I need to do some sort of turning around and picking apart. And yeah, that's actually led to a real sense of freedom. So yeah, recently I've been really dwelling on that story.
When you say dwelling, how dwelling have you been dwelling?
How dwelling have I been dwelling? I've just been thinking about it a lot and being reminded about it as I'm sort of going through my daily life in work and stuff.
Maybe it could be part of a book narrative later on.
Maybe.
Question three. If you were Prime Minister for the day, Lydia, and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be?
A very trivial thing that jumps to mind is...
Oh, we like this. We like trivial stuff.
Yeah, just Make train travel cheaper.
Oh, very good.
I'm just shocked at how expensive trains are.
Yeah.
And then you get on a train and it's always rammed and it's always, you know, you might not even get your reserve seat. It's just, yeah, trains. I could go on about it for ages, so I'm not going to. But in reality, if I was trying to impose a new law, it's incredibly hard to decide which one it would be because there's so many factors I don't understand. And I'm not afraid to admit that I don't understand a lot of factors. So
that's good. No, I like that. A really good friend of mine, 3 years ago, I had to go from Bristol up to Leeds for a business meeting, and it was like £300 to go up there on a train.
Yeah.
So to prove a point, he actually flew to Dublin from Bristol Airport, caught a flight to Leeds, got there before the train, and saved £50.
Yeah. We had that once. We were trying to get to Cornwall, and it was going to be cheaper for us to fly from Leeds to Belfast and then fly to Newquay, I think, from Belfast or something.
Yeah, you can do that, yeah.
Which is just ridiculous.
Well, I can hear lots of people going, preach it, sister, book it, you are the next Prime Minister. Very good.
Oh, please no. Please no.
Yeah, but think of all the free football tickets you'll get.
I would, wouldn't I?
Yeah.
I would get a lot of free football tickets.
Yeah, you would. And a lot of free football shirts, especially of the away team with your name on the back.
Yeah, maybe that's another law I'd impose. Make those cheaper. They're really expensive as well.
Your stock is rising all the time now. And you're going to be getting party political people knocking on your door after this. Come and work for us.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'd just make everything cheaper. But as I say, I don't understand what implications that would have. I think it would just cause chaos.
Doesn't matter. Just do it. Question four. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out so far, please, Lydia?
Do you know, the other month I decided to take myself to Whitby on the bus.
Oh, yeah.
Which took forever. However, it's supposed to be Britain's most scenic bus ride.
Is it?
Yeah, but it was really misty, so we didn't see any of the scenery. But I took myself to Whitby because I just felt like I needed a day. And I went and had coffee, obviously. And then I walked around, walked along the beach, went to a bookshop, bought myself a couple of new books, went back to the same coffee shop, drank coffee, started reading my books, and then went home. And it was amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. So if I was spending a day by myself, that's what I would choose to do. Yeah, very simple.
Well, you assume Whitby has loads of fish and chip shops, so you must have fish and chips at lunchtime.
This is going to make me sound really lame. I took a packed lunch.
Very good.
Yeah, I took a packed lunch.
A lot cheaper. And of course, the bus ride would have been a lot cheaper than the train, if the train still goes to Whitby.
Oh, well, yeah, because it's on the £2 cap. So it cost me £2.
What £2 cap?
So at the moment, I think it's still going. The government made every bus route across the country £2.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I can get from York to Whitby for £2. There you go. My cup of tea, nice and cheap.
That's very good. Question five. What has been your most embarrassing moment to date then, please?
It's not appropriate to talk about. It's going to be my answer. Oh. I really can't talk about it. Because if I gave you another answer, it wouldn't be truthful. Because
right.
That wouldn't be my most embarrassing moment. My most embarrassing moment is just not appropriate.
Does it involve toilets by a chance?
Something in that vicinity. But yeah, I just can't talk about it, Martin. If we were having a drink down the pub, I'd probably tell you, but not now.
Is it worth my while flying over just to find out what it
is? No, it's definitely not worth that. It's not worth that. Actually, your reaction would probably be, oh, bless you. That would be your reaction.
You are the first person, nearly 100 episodes, whereby you can't share your most embarrassing moment. It is that bad. Tell you what. You'll have to tell me off air if that's all right.
I will. And if any friends or family who are close to me listen to this, they know exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. Well, that's all we have time today. Thank you so much for joining us, Lydia. I'm looking forward to the end. Thank you. I did mention the fact that you're known as LG Jenkins, although I can call you Lydia.
Mm-hmm.
So question is, foot number one, why LG and not Lydia Jenkins?
So when I was first writing these books, I actually had some friends look at them, and originally I was actually going to use Lydia Grace, so Grace is my middle name, classic, you know, 90s Christian child, Lydia Grace. And with the content of the books, one of the people who was doing some like constructive criticism for me actually said Lydia Grace is a really feminine name, and essentially they were saying for the content of the book, it's too feminine, it's too soft of an author name, which I thought was an interesting insight. And so then I just decided, well, why don't I just use my initials? It was as simple as that.
Oh, that's a good answer.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with the fact that you want to be sponsored by a major TV manufacturer or anything else like that then?
Absolutely not. No. I just thought, I'll just use my initials. And that was it.
Because it's interesting just how many people in the literary world use their initials.
Mm.
You know, I'm thinking of J.K. Rowling, for instance, J.R.R. Tolkien, all these people.
Yeah.
C.S. Lewis.
Yeah. I don't really know the reason why, actually. I don't know whether it's like to... So you don't know their gender initially. I don't know. But like, not that that would really matter, I don't suppose.
Yeah.
But no, it was simply a thought and I thought, oh, that sounds quite good. And I stuck with it.
You did say there, I take it you're brought up in a Christian home, especially if you recall Grace as your second name. So what was your childhood experience like?
I had a great childhood. I'm very thankful to my parents in the way that they raised me and my two brothers. So I grew up in a Christian home. We attended a local Baptist church. My dad was the elder there. You know, my life wasn't completely dominated by church, but it was a big part of it. I did go through a period, probably my mom always used to say that I had my like teenage terror years between the ages of 9 and 12.
Oh.
So in terms of, you know, moodiness and disobedience, I sort of bloomed early. So between those sorts of ages, I wasn't really bothered about church. I was much more or anything to do with faith. I was much more interested in friends and school and being out late and not coming back when my parents told me to come back and that sort of thing. But then I had an experience at school that actually I got into trouble and accused of something I still to this day believe I didn't actually do.
Mm-hmm.
And that experience sort of knocked a few things out of me. And I realized, no, I do want to do well in life. I do want to have good friends. I do want to, you know, have a good relationship with my parents and that sort of thing. So it was a bit of a blessing in disguise, really. And so I sort of made a switch and made some decisions. Yeah, I think I was 12, 13 or something like that. And then by the time I was 14, I was very much believing in Jesus as my savior and then got baptized. So I realize you asked about my childhood, but that's just turned into my testimony. But I suppose a lot of my childhood was.
No, that's great. Having got that as your background,
mm-hmm.
why would you want to suddenly think, oh, do you know what? I want to start writing dystopian novels. So for those that don't really know what a dystopian novel is, first of all, what is a dystopian novel?
Yeah, so dystopian fiction is usually set in the future and it is usually quite a dark, depressing setting where the world or society is under some sort of totalitarian or oppressive rule or regime.
Mm-hmm.
And it often follows characters within those societies who are either trying to cater to it or are exposed to things that show its corruption. And so you follow those characters in how they navigate that. And a lot of the classic dystopian tropes are, you know, totalitarianism. If you think about things like Brave New World and George Orwell's 1984, more young adult stuff like The Hunger Games is actually more about individual self-expression in the face of adversity. And you often, with dystopian fiction, there is a central critique behind the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So the author is making a criticism about the society that they are living in. So 1984, for example, and Brave New World, they were very much after the Industrial Revolution and society was moving on with technology. They were warnings against the uses of technology and how actually if we push it too far, we're going to lose our humanity.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. Which is really interesting. And so people have actually said that Suzanne Collins, who wrote The Hunger Games, some of her critique of society was the huge gap between the rich and poor. So in The Hunger Games, you've got the capital and then districts. And she's actually making a comment of like, you know, this isn't right that we've got this huge gap. But yeah, the young adult stuff like The Hunger Games and Divergent and The Uglies and all of those other things are looking much more at young people's self-expression, as you'd expect with a young adult novel. But yeah, I hope that gives some insight.
Yeah, it does. It's like an allegory, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
One of my all-time heroes, Patrick McGoohan, was in a TV series called The Prisoner. And that's where I first learnt all about allegories.
Right.
You need to watch it.
Okay, I will put that on my very long list
Please.
Of things to...
It's now on ITVX.
Okay.
And Christopher Nolan, the film director, is going to be making, they think, a film about it now as well.
Oh,
oh yes. I'm not a number, I'm a free man. There you go. Dystopian or what? I think so. So thank you for telling us what a dystopian story is. With your background and everything else, you go to university to study, I think it was English, wasn't it?
Yeah.
What do you remember about your time at university?
I remember coming to the end of my third year. I was in the library with some friends and we used to like meet in the foyer bit to eat our sandwiches and whatever.
Which university?
University of York. Yeah, so I studied here. And I remember coming down at lunchtime and saying to one of my friends, I am done. I am done with academia. I am done writing. I am done reading books, because I was just so exhausted. Yeah. So I remember it being really hard work, but also a lot of fun. Like, I've made amazing friends of university that I'm still friends with now. However, when I was at university, even though I was studying literature, I never once thought about writing a novel. That was never something that I'd considered doing. I'd done an internship the summer of my first year in marketing, and I decided I enjoy marketing. So at the end of my third year, I decided to get a job in marketing through an estate agent, and that sort of set me on a path on a marketing career. But then 2.5 years in, maybe, into my working career, I actually got made redundant, which was a really strange time, because it was a time where I, for the first time, I didn't really know what to do, which was both exciting but upsetting, because it's like, well, you know, I've gone from doing my GCSEs to doing my A-levels to going into university and then going into a job. I've always had a plan, and it was sort of like laid out for me. And it had always, every single year, I'd achieved something. I'd either got a grade or, I don't know, maybe like a pay rise at the end of my first year of job, which I didn't get, which is another issue I think a lot of young people struggle with, is that we expect something at the end of every year of work. And that's not how the working world works at all. But anyway, so when I got made redundant, I realized I had a really unhealthy relationship with work, and that my whole identity, my whole self-worth was actually tied to it, was tied to how well I was doing, how much money I was earning in comparison to my friends as well. And I just realized, oh, this is not good for me. And it took getting made redundant to realize that. It took getting made redundant to realize that I was chasing a job, I was chasing status, I was chasing validation, all things that were never going to satisfy me. That's when I was processing these things, I mean, I believe it was God-given that I felt to write a dystopian series about it. Yeah, I remember saying to my husband as I was sort of figuring out what to do, I said, I think God wants me to write a book. And he said, that's a great idea. So we went down to the pub, as you do, went down to the pub and chatted about it. And this world just started to come alive in my head. And yeah, so that was in 2019. So quite a while ago now. And so I actually did publish the first two under different titles.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of during lockdown. But then I had, lockdown obviously happened, but then I also had a lot of quite big life changes happen. And so this time last year, I sort of decided, you know what? I don't think the titles are strong enough. I don't think the covers are strong enough. I'm going to do this again. I re-edited book one, which became Son of Endless Days, and book two, and which is now Storm at Dusk, and the third one, which the title has not yet properly been revealed, but I will tell you.
Thank you. Drum roll.
It's called Quiet Echoes at Night.
Oh, not my most embarrassing moment then.
No. But that's coming out in November.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're rattling on with it.
What's it called again?
Quiet Echoes at Night.
Ooh, that's a good title. Yeah. I like that.
There's four, so there's another one after it. And then it is finished. But yeah, that's sort of, I know you asked about university, but it sort of led on to that.
No, I'm glad you did, because we're getting a bigger picture of you. Mm-hmm. Something you said you had like a life-changing experience or two. What was that?
Yeah, so I guess the main one was that my mum passed away in November. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she had, last July, she went into hospital with confusion, dizziness. I mean, she had some other history of health issues to do with her brain. It wasn't like cancerous or anything. Yeah, she basically had a very rare autoimmune disease that attacked a certain receptor in her brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so last July, she went in a week later after like serious deterioration. She was basically in a coma, and she was in a coma for 4 months before she passed away. So that obviously, in terms of writing or marketing or any sort of momentum, just put everything on hold, which was okay, that's fine. But it was definitely a lesson in sort of processing that the relationships in your life are the most important thing. And actually certain things like your career or projects or things that often feel so important, and they are important, it's not downplaying that, actually don't really mean very much in the face of something like that. So yeah, I'm glad I've redone it to gain that momentum back. And I think mum would be proud that I've done that. But yeah, that was probably the main massive change.
Yeah. I'm guessing here you're still under 30 years of age sort of thing.
Yes. Just by 2 years. Actually, no, scarily, a year and a couple of months.
Oh. Well, to your credit, you sound very mature with your feet properly on the ground. So I think it's phenomenal that you've had all these experiences so far and you're now trusting God completely. And guess what? You put it in the form of a book or two. So with your dystopian themes, I'm beginning to see a pattern of it. Where does your own Christian faith fit into these books, your dystopian series?
I mean, there is a central allegory in it. There is a piece of technology in the books called the Guiding Light, which I haven't tried to force too much as an allegory for Christ, but it is essentially. But you wouldn't be able to tell if you didn't know the gospel, to be fair.
Right.
So that's one aspect. But it's also, my faith comes into it when it comes to the values that I'm critiquing. So very much critiquing a life that is always being driven for you, you know, living a very selfish, ambitious life towards gaining. Because the idea is that every citizen has a merit score, and everything they do either rewards them to their score or detracts points from their score.
Uh-huh.
That can also depend on the relationships they're in, the people they hang around with, the food they eat, the exercise they do, everything, basically. And so very obviously you can see how selfishly people are wired.
Uh-huh.
And there's another community who aren't wired like that. Because there's four books, there's so many different values and layers and lessons and all of those things that come out. But the central thing that I'm trying to communicate, and I would love to talk to young people about, is, especially young people of faith, is how do we live in the way that Christ talked about, you know, living life to the full? How do we live life to the full in such a busy modern world where everything is about external validation?
Uh-huh.
How do we actually do that? And I don't know the answer yet. I'm still figuring that out. And writing these books in a weird roundabout way has been a way for me to do that. And so I think my Christian values and my Christian faith, I would like to think, is sort of woven within all of it, both in its contrasting with the darker characters in the book,
mm-hmm.
and also the ones who maybe reflect more of the values that I have.
Because when we think about C.S. Lewis, we think about The Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
Loads of people, especially in the 60s, 70s, 80s, going to primary school and beyond, would have read those books, even though they weren't going to church, let alone being a Christian. So it's great to hear that your book could be picked up by a person in school. I think, oh, I'll just read this. This seems quite good. Not having a clue until maybe years later when they can reflect. I think that's phenomenal. And the fact that you're prepared to go down the pub immediately makes me think of the Inklings, you know, C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien going down the pub and having a chat.
Yeah.
For your husband to say, actually, that's a really good idea, that is. Go for it. So how long did it take to write your first book?
So writing the first book was about 18 months, probably, because I was working. I did get another job in marketing. So I did it alongside working. But I did have a day off. I had a four-day week.
Okay.
So I did have Fridays, which were technically supposed to be my writing day, but quite often they became full with laundry and other things, you know. I had to force myself to get out of the house so I didn't get distracted with that sort of thing. So the first one was about 18 months. The second one, because we were in lockdown, took about a year. It was just a bit quicker because I had more time.
Yes.
The third one has taken me a long time. Mainly because obviously I've relaunched the first two. I had my mum's illness.
Mm-hmm.
It's just taken me a long time. It's probably taken me best part of 2 years.
Yeah, yeah.
I have finished the first draft of the fourth one, and I've been working on that for about a year so far.
So how do you go about it then, as far as writing a book?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a thing in the writing world, like a question of, are you a plotter or I think it's a pantster? I think that's how you say it.
Don't even know what that word means, let alone.
I think it means basically you don't plan, you just write.
Oh, okay.
And then you come back and you edit it all later.
Oh, okay.
So I would say that is my natural way of going about a book. Like, I will have ideas of what a character is like. So I will plan out like their profiles. I'll have a general idea of where the plot is going. But I do tend to just word vomit and see what happens.
Okay.
Because quite often the characters will sort of direct the plot, because you get to know the sort of decisions that they would make. And actually you recognize halfway through writing it that the way that you were going, that character would never actually make that decision because of who they are.
Yeah, yeah.
So things then have to change. But I have forced myself to be a bit more of a plotter, because it does mean that you've got less editing to do afterwards. So I have, especially for book 3 and 4, there's a great book called Save the Cat Writes a Novel by Jessica Brody. And it basically goes through, in a very mathematical way, the different aspects of a story, in terms of, you know, you have the first act where you've got a character who's got a problem that they need to solve. And then you go into act 2 when you hit a catalyst. So their world completely changes and they go into another world, or they, you know, somebody dies or something catastrophic happens that means they're forced into a different life. And then you have another act where they're sort of navigating that. And then you have like the all is lost. You know, that moment in a film or a book where the character's just walking through the streets and it's raining. Like, it's that sort of moment. And then you have where they basically learn the central lesson that they needed to learn. And then they go on and sort out the problem. So that book, Save the Cat Writes a Novel, has been very instrumental, particularly for the writing of book 3 and 4. And so it's made me plot much more than I have before. So yeah, and it actually helped me with re-editing the first one as well.
Because I would have thought you'd have, certainly in my case, if I had the nous to even write a book, that I'd get flip chart pages after flip chart pages, put them all around the room saying, right, okay, that's a character pot there, that's a person there, so forth and so forth. But obviously in the digital world, that doesn't exist. So you've either got to be very brainy, remember everything, or write it down.
Yeah.
Of course, another thing is, where are you going to get all the names from? So, for instance, Tulo City, AJ.
So I did have another name for the city, and I think it was something like Camjor or something. I can't remember. But then I recognised it was very similar to, do you know the series Divergent? It's a young adult.
Seen the films.
So the factions within the Divergent Society, one of them is called Kanjor. So my original name for the city was very similar to that. So I had to change it. And you know what? I think I Googled, it's an African word, Tulo, I think. And it's something to do with, it sounds really random and doesn't really make any sense, but it's something to do with a leaky bucket. So it's the idea that you've got this bucket that looks like it works, which is the idea that the city looks like it works, but it's got loads of holes in it and things are leaking all over the place.
Very good.
It's a bit tenuous, but I don't know. Honestly, it was so long ago that you sort of forget how you get there. AJ and Jenny, I couldn't tell you. I know I wanted with AJ Ambers, I wanted a name with, you know, like superheroes where they've got the same, like Peter Parker, and they've got the same letter of the first and last name. There's a word for it. I can't.
There is a word for it.
It's not.
Yes.
Coming to me. I knew I wanted that and I don't know why. But yeah, they just sort of came. I don't really.
Okay.
I don't really have a process. I definitely, with the names, and there's a reason for it, which is revealed in some of the later books. I definitely wanted the names to be a little bit different than names we would typically hear. So like spelling Jenny with a G.
Yes.
And that sort of thing. And there's a few strange spellings of names that we would be familiar with. And there is a reason for that, but I won't tell you what it is.
Quite right too. Quite right too. We have to buy book 4 of the series.
Exactly. See what happens.
Yeah. All will be revealed. Very good. Very good marketing. Because I know there are loads of people I've met He said, "Oh, I'm writing a book. It's a novel sort of thing." So, oh, great. Let's read it. And it never quite comes to fruition. And then a couple of times people self-publish.
Yeah.
When did you realise that actually you might well be onto a winner here and this needs to really go big time and find a proper publisher?
I mean, when I first did it, I didn't have a clue about the publishing world at all. I was probably quite naive, actually. And I knew, so Malcolm Down Publishing is my publisher,
yeah.
But I'm under the Grace and Down imprint. I had a contact who knew Malcolm. I got introduced to him. We had a chat and all of that. And I sent my manuscript off to him and I had some feedback and all of that sort of stuff. And then he said he wanted to take it on. So it actually happened sort of straight away. Now, his publishing house works on a different model to like the biggest publishers. It's a smaller publishing house. But what I would say is that it's given me more than self-publishing would have done,
mm-hmm.
in terms of their distribution, their connection, particularly with the Christian trade. You know, we're still very early days having relaunched the series, but there's a few things happening in the background. But I would say to anyone, from my experience, what I didn't really do, and I still believe I made the right decision because I was very prayerful about it. What I didn't really do was explore all the different options. I didn't really go down the road of doing query letters to agents to try and get it traditionally published.
Mm-hmm.
In hindsight, I believe I could have done that, but I don't know whether it would have ever been accepted. With traditional publishing, you do lose some levels of creative control, which is a whole separate conversation. But yeah, I would say for anyone who is looking to publish a book, look more at all of your options, because I didn't. And sometimes you do get that, oh, what if I'd tried that?
Yeah. Such as what?
Yeah, so I do wonder whether I should have tried trying to get an agent.
Because?
Because I don't know what would have happened.
Oh, right.
You know, would my books have more potential to go really big if I had done that? But mm-hmm. is that the intention? Is that God's intention? Maybe not. Probably not. Let's explore that
because, you know, I paid you a genuine compliment. I think you're very well grounded, very real, very mature for the age, but like everything in life, we have to learn. We have to show to God that we can do the basics well first, and then he'll move us on to a bigger project and then bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
So consequently, yeah. You know, if I was Mr. Hollywood, as in city, town thing in America, and came over and a thick American accent said, "Gee, I love your book. Let me buy it."
Mm-hmm.
Would you be able to cope with it?
Well, I don't know. When I first wrote it, I was 24 maybe. Yeah, 24. And if it had been picked up by a big publisher, as you say, like it could have been awful for me. Like I might not have been able to deal with the deadlines. I have no idea.
Yeah.
And also what's been really fascinating with my faith walk as I've been doing it is and it's so ironic because, you know, what I'm trying to say in these is it's about not striving for external validation and being content with where you are. And yes, working hard, but knowing why you're working hard,
mm-hmm.
and knowing your purpose and really going for that. And so many times when I've been trying to make these books successful, I've been caught up with the fact that I'm acting just like my characters act. And it's just been a brilliant tool that God has used to call me out. Actually, if it had all worked seamlessly and become, you know, the next million whatever bestseller, would I have learned those lessons and would I be learning the lessons I'm still learning now? Probably not. My ego probably would have been even more pampered. I think sometimes God really protects us from things that we think we want, but it's not his best for us.
You mentioned C word, content.
Mm-hmm.
What does content mean to you, Lydia?
What does content mean to you? That's such a good question. And I think the answer to that question has probably changed over the last couple of years, especially with the experiences I've had. They would have been being completely satisfied with everything in my life. But now it's living within God's will and knowing that I'm living within his will. Even if things are difficult, even if I'm struggling, even if I'm tired, like it's okay to be tired. Even if things don't look the way I thought they would, actually it's really leaning into my faith and trying to gain God's perspective on where I am. And if I feel like he's saying, nope, we're on the right track, then I'm content with that.
Brilliant. Because if I was that Mr. Hollywood with an open check came to you and said, I love the stories, I'll check to Mr. Down Publishers, I'll get that all sorted. When you're 24, would you have been able to cope with that? And all the stuff that comes with it, the finances, yes, money is great and all that. But, you know, where would you be able to cope with your life and your family and everything else like that? It's an easy question in some ways and a very difficult question to answer in other ways, I would have thought. And maybe you could use that to put in your book. So what other turmoils have you had to think, do you know what, I want to use that in the book?
So, I mean, there's so many and I'm trying to, like, pick which one. Not necessarily a turmoil that I've had, but in the second book, I do touch on cancel culture a little bit.
Okay.
Because I've seen some of the hurt that that causes in terms of online abuse and that sort of thing. And there is a character who goes through that. So there's a lot of things that come into it, that the turmoils that people face in a modern context. I think in terms of my own, is recognizing the need to intentionally invest in friendships and relationships and intentionally give and intentionally forgive as well. There's a note that I've written for book three that is about my relationship with my mum, and the relationship I did have with my mum was really strong, but it hadn't always been, and we only got there because we invested in each other. And that's one of the messages that I'm trying to get through in this story is, you know, when you're so concentrated on your own success, your own achievements, which are not bad things to chase in and of themselves, but when they become your everything, the things that should be really important are neglected.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that experience with my relationship with my mum is something that definitely in the last two books, hopefully comes through quite well.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
You're still in your brain remembering what it was like to be a child. You know, just sort of 15 years ago, but you're now in that position whereby, you know, in a few years to come, you most probably be a mother. So you're at a very interesting point in life. So for those mothers that have maybe got, and I love the word obstreperous because my granny used to use that word and she never knew what it meant. For those parents that are listening at the moment, they've got, they think, major issues with their children.
Mm-hmm.
Having been one of those people that was trying to go through a particular issue at school or whatever, what would you say to them first of all?
Listen, I would probably say. And not trying to, I guess, force the issue. I think sometimes we can, you know, you can apply it to any relationship. You can see that something's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But quite often, trying to tease something out of someone, depending on where they are, might not be the best approach. So being available and listening and working through it, especially with teenagers, working through things rather than approaching it. I can't remember what it's called, but there's a particular way of addressing conflict where we've got the three voices. We've got the child voice, the adult voice, and the parent voice.
Conflict resolution.
Yeah. And actually, I think with teenagers, it's sort of recognizing that, yes, they're still a child, but they're actually developing into a new adult. So do we need to, while we need to have the disciplinarian side, do we need to actually recognize that a little bit more? I don't know. And actually come to them as an adult. It's a hard question for me to answer because I'm not a parent, but I think there's a definite need in this generation to feel like they're being heard and not talked down at all the time. Yeah.
Where do you see these books going then? And what do you want to achieve through these books then, Lydia?
So, I mean, I do actually have more ideas for more books in this series. Yeah. Not in this series, but set in this world.
Spin-offs.
Yeah, little spin-offs. Maybe even like some romances. Because for a long time I was like, oh, I'm not a romance author. Like, I don't really like romance. And then I was like, Lydia, you're kidding yourself. You're a sucker for a romance. You love reading like a romance. So, yeah, like there's a few ideas I've got. So potentially, you know, going that route, drumming up some interest from some slightly different readers who might be interested in the original series. But my vision for it really, as I said, is I'd love them to be a tool to speak to young people, not just of faith, but speaking to young people about how to navigate, particularly their 20s.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think it's a gap in, particularly in church ministry, I think it's a gap. You know, students get ministry, but as soon as you go into the world of work, you're sort of, you're in it with the rest of us.
Yeah.
And your 20s are a very tender time because you're trying to almost make a name for yourself.
Uh-huh.
You know, in independence. Especially now you've got social media selling you a lifestyle that most of us can't actually afford.
Uh-huh.
You lose friends because you drift. And then it's very difficult. You have to be very intentional about making new ones. So it can be a very lonely time of your life. So yeah, I'd love them to be a tool where I could go in and maybe into churches and youth spaces and student spaces and just have conversations with people how they're really doing and how they're navigating it. What does success look like for them? And how to be restful while being productive, but prioritizing the right things. Yeah, that would be the vision. How God is going to make that happen, I've let that go because I've tried trying to force it and it doesn't work. There's no grace in doing that. So yeah, I'm starting to surrender that and just seeing what happens.
Wow. And you mentioned the S word as well, from content to surrender. So I'm going to ask the same type of question to you again. What does surrender mean to you then, Lydia?
Surrender means to me just letting it go and recognizing that the only thing I truly need to worry about is if I'm being obedient to what God is calling me to do right here, right now, in this moment, in this season. And the things that I want or desire might not necessarily be bad, but He will give me them if I need them. And also recognizing that as I get to know God better, my desires are going to change because the desires of His heart will become the desires of my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And just being willing for that, being willing to give up what I might intend for my life, because I know that God's got a better plan than I do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much freedom in that. Like, thank goodness, because I don't know what I'm doing.
The thing is, though, if God, as soon as we finish this podcast, okay, this is purely hypothetical, so please treat it as that.
Yeah.
Obviously with a serious answer attached to it. If all of a sudden, after this podcast, God says to you, do you know what, Lydia? Brilliant books, but I don't want you to write anymore. In fact, I want you to totally give up writing books. How would you feel?
I'd feel sad. There would be a grieving process to go through with that because it's something you've invested in. It's something that I'm passionate about. But at the same time, I think my question to God would probably be, okay, if that's a don't, what's the do?
Mm.
What do you want me to do instead? And I can imagine that it would be something that I would have enthusiasm for and that He would really drive me forwards for, and I would recognize a purpose for. And so, yeah, there's no denying that that would be sad. I think it would be a bit of a lie for me to say, oh, well, that would be brilliant, whatever God says, you know, because I think that's all part of the Christian life and the walk of faith, is that you have to deny yourself. You have to do that. But that doesn't mean that it's easy. If it was easy, it would have absolutely no meaning. It wouldn't mean anything. It wouldn't be a sacrifice. So, yeah, I would feel sad, but I would be ready to see what God would have me do instead.
Hand on heart, could you do it?
Could I do it?
Yeah.
Not without a lot of prayer.
Good answer. Good answer. And the reason why I'm asking that, you've said two things, actually. Mm-hmm. First of all, that you need to listen. So, you know, I've been doing that, as I always try to do on these podcasts, because that's the most important thing before you frame a question, just listen to what's been said. But you said the G word this time, grieve. Mm. And to your credit, what you most probably don't know about my life, apart from the little backstory that I shared with you, is that having given up a previous career as a training officer, I then went into radio more straight away, which is what I've always wanted to do. By this time, I thought I was a fervent Christian doing what God wanted me to do, went into radio. This is what I've been working for from the age of three. That's all I've wanted to do, God. Thank you, God. I then meet my now wife, and a few years later in the radio business, we then find out my wife had cancer, became registered blind, and all of a sudden we had a little baby boy.
Mm.
And I had to give everything up. Because it meant that there was no one else to look after a wife who was with cancer by this time, registered blind, all the other illnesses you can go through the alphabet she's had. And that's not exaggerating, that's actually genuine.
Right.
And there was no one else to look after a little 18-month-old. So I had to give up work. And you've nailed it for me, because the past 21, 22 years has been the right thing to do. And I would make the same decision again. It's been incredibly hard.
Yeah.
But I haven't been able to grieve, because it was like straight out of the fire into the frying pan for me. There was no peace. I just had to do it.
Right.
And I think what you said there with regard to grieving is is very, very true. So thank you for that.
Yeah.
That's meant a lot to me.
Mm.
You seem to have a passion here for the teenagers. Where does this passion come from? Why?
I think it's just from my own experiences. So I would say the passion really is, it is for teenagers, but late teenagers going into new adulthood, I guess is what you'd say. And I think it's just come from my own experiences. I think it's when I got made redundant, I just recognized how much I relied on the validation of like my managers, how much I relied on whether I was doing well compared to my friends. So there was a bit of a competitive edge, which is complete nonsense now looking back when I'm older, because they're my friends, you know, we're friends, we have deep friendships. And so why does it matter what each of us earn or what each of us do? Like, so I just recognized a real issue in society, definitely for this generation, that one, we have so much choice, which is really quite paralyzing, because you never really know whether what you're doing is the right thing. So that causes anxiety. So then you have another tension of sometimes you might be in a scenario where you feel like you don't have much choice, like yourself, Martin, that you've just shared. And that causes anxiety as well. So you have to exist in this middle point where there's always going to be that tension. And for me, that middle point has become trusting God, because there is no other way. There isn't any other way to be free from that anxiety. And I think I'm so passionate about this generation, because they're sort of stuck between those two places. And it's always anxiety inducing. And, you know, social media makes that so much worse. But I will say there is good uses for social media. There are amazing ways to connect with people on there, and there are amazing ways to talk about different important things. And there's amazing ways to make people laugh as well, which I do enjoy doing. And so, yeah, I think I'm just so passionate about it because I know what it's like, and I know what the trenches of your 20s is like, especially in this environment. And for those in the generation below me, I feel like it could only get worse with the development of loads of different things that might be happening. So, yeah, don't know if that sums it up.
Well, it does, because like you, as you are now more involved in the literary world, you know, you're going to meet more, I suppose you call them lovies, you write books and things like that. You're going to be meeting more and more authors.
Yeah.
In my case, especially in the 90s and the early noughties, in a number of Christian bands that, you know, I'd go and interview and share a cup of coffee or two afterwards with. One of the biggest things that ever said to me was by a very, very well-known band. And I said, so what are you learning on your road trip at the moment, or on your world tour? Or it wasn't quite a world tour at the time. And they said, well, we have a pastor on board, and he keeps saying to us every day, same thing. What is the definition of trust? And it is trusting God without a backup plan.
Yeah.
And I think this is what you're maybe trying to say here as well. So that's what I understand it to mean. What does it mean to you?
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And that's really resonated quite deeply, because I'm someone who wants a backup plan. And I do it automatically without me even realizing it. I'm like, well, if that doesn't work out, I'll do this.
Yes.
And I've already made the backup plan.
Yes.
And therefore, my trust has already been diminished. So I would agree with that. I think, there's just, for me, just trusting that God knows the best. And I think that's something that I've tried to develop in my own walk is, okay, Lord, this seems right. This seems good. It seems as if it could be from you, but is it the best? And yeah, that's what I would want. I want God's best, even if that's hard.
Well, you've certainly gone through the experiences, and for the teenagers, 20-year-old something, 50-year-old something, 60-year-old something that's listening today, that might be at that crossroads thinking, yeah, but I've done everything, I wanted to do. I've worked hard. I've done this for you, God. I've done that for you, God. I've gone to church every Sunday, blah, 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 blah. And they're at this big crossroads now where it feels as the world is falling apart underneath their feet. You've got 1 minute in which to say something to them. What would you say to them?
Oh, my goodness.
We can say that for a start, yeah.
Well, yeah. Oh, my goodness. I think I'd probably ask them the question, where is your treasure? You know, what is the thing that you're really striving for? And is it truly getting to know God better? Because the reality is it probably isn't. But once it becomes that, by really seeking with no other agenda, the way forward will become clear. And I would also say, and this is something that I'm really learning, I read in the Bible this morning, the parable about the widow and the judge, which I don't think a lot of people, it was Luke 17 or 18. We don't talk about it a lot. And it's basically a widow comes before a judge and says, please pardon me of some charges or something like that. And the judge doesn't initially, but she keeps coming back. Yes. She keeps coming back. And eventually he grants her what she's asking for. And Jesus is saying, do not lose heart. Continue to pray. And that's something that God's really teaching me, that pray, ask me, continue to pray for things that are the deepest longings of your heart, and have faith that he will be faithful. So I think it's examining what you're striving for, whether you're wanting to get to know God, and continuing to pray would be what I'd say.
Phenomenal answer. Lydia, thank you so much. Time has beaten us.
It has. It really has.
I know. It's amazing. You shared some amazing insights. Thank you very much indeed. Just reminds me now, as we finish, to ask you the final question. So, Lydia Jenkins, or LG.
Yeah.
Who is your Christian hero, please?
So, it's completely cliche, and we've already talked about him, but he's the first person that jumps to mind, and it is C.S. Lewis. But not for maybe the obvious answer of, wow, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia and the allegory and the storytelling and all of that is amazing. You know, the bit in The Magician's Nephew where you see the power of God through when Aslan creates Narnia, is just something that will always stick with me. But actually recently, with the experiences that I've had, I read A Grief Observed, and it just hit me, his faithfulness and his ability to write amazing children's stories, but then also write really raw, honest material. And that's something that I find deeply inspiring. And like, if I could share some of my experience through writing in the ways that he has, that would be like a complete honor. So yeah, it was, when I was thinking about this question, I couldn't really think of anyone else, because I've experienced his joyful storytelling with his very raw, honest writing. And as a writer, that's something that I really aspire to.
Which is phenomenal. And do you know what? Over the past couple of months, the number one answer seems to be at the moment C.S. Lewis. We're going through a massive C.S. Lewis revival.
Well, there you go.
And there's nothing wrong with that at all.
No.
Good old Clive Staples. You see, C.S., Clive Staples. From Northern Ireland, of course. The Inklings going down to the pub to talk things through.
That's it. Ultimate inspiration.
Absolutely amazing. Lydia, I really wish you every success for the future. I'm looking forward to reading your books.
Thank you very much.
It's great what you're doing. And, of course, the sequels as well. And if I could buy your film rights for a quid, let me know.
All right, I will do. I'll do some evaluations.
Yes, it might get up to £1.50, but you know, it's I can see it's going to be brilliant, especially with what you've been sharing today. Lydia, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been brilliant. Thank you. God bless. Next time on Off Grid Christianity.
Some of the moments where I first encountered the Lord, he had this way of just bringing this assurance that everything was going to be okay. And he had this way of, I don't know, just speaking to me either to my heart or through a book or through a movie or through a person. And this was one of those moments where everything inside of me believed everything she was saying. And for that reason, I was like, oh, I don't have any doubt that God is with me. And I needed that because I had experience because of my dad's situation, him, you know, being in and out of my life and him being struggling with addiction. I had seen empty promises. I had seen my dad fail. So for me to get to this point where I can believe that my father in heaven was different and that he's a God that doesn't fail, it took him like just being intentional with me and being patient with me. And I think that's what I needed to be able to see God in the light that I see him today.
So please join me for the next episode with special guest, Kieran. Until then, cheerio.